Imogen Cooper playing the Nocturne in D-flat major opus 27 number 2 and the Ballade in F minor opus 52 by Chopin to end this Radio 3 lunchtime recital broadcast live from Wigmore Hall in London. And don't you just hear the cheers? That really was an astonishing tour de force, the whole programme. Next Monday lunchtime, Fiona Talkington will be here at Wigmore Hall to introduce an excitingly eclectic recital by countertenor Yestin Davis and pianist Julius Drake. But meanwhile, with the cheers ringing on, I'll hand you back to Broadcasting House.
And the recital was introduced by Catherine Bott. This is BBC Radio 3. Now it's time for World Roots. And this week we join Andy Kershaw for highlights from the Siam Ring Festival in southern Siberia.
Добрый вечер, Шушинская.
This is throat-singing country. Yes, I'm in Shushinskaya, in deepest Siberia, right down in the south, near the Mongolian border, just a stone's throw from Tuva, which is where these guys are from. Until the 1980s, Shushinskaya was a thriving tourist town because this is where Lenin came when he was exiled to Siberia as a troublemaker by the Tsar in the 1890s. There's still a Lenin museum here, and one huge but crumbling hotel, more of that later. But since 1989, no one's cared much about Lenin. So to try to keep the tourists coming, the town decided to turn to music and culture. In 2004, the Siam Ring Festival began here. It's really a kind of WOMAD with Cyrillics and mutant mosquitoes. There's throat singers aplenty, and there's also some unheard-of and unforgettable artists from the new Russian republics. Some old favourites of mine have turned up too. The veteran German-Moroccan rockers, Dissidenten, who recorded one of the best North African dance tracks ever, Fata Morgana. So let's enjoy the festival, the fun, the food, the flies, and any other Fs we can fit in. And some great music, starting with local boys, Hunhur 2.
Yeah.
With shameless disregard for conflicts of interest, the manager of Hun Huatu is also one of the founders and artistic directors of the Siren Ring Festival. He's a Russian based in Moscow, Alexander Cheparukin.
The unique situation here is that there are nations here who are very different from Russians, who are maybe closer to Mongolians by their way of life, by their nomadic roots, like Tuva, Khakassia, Altai, Yakutia. And I think that the main purpose of Siren Ring Festival is to discover people who are not only preserving the traditional culture, but also developing traditional culture. Because I think that traditional culture, if it exists in the level of museum, it's a kind of a conservation of tradition. The worst case is dying of tradition. So tradition, in order to be alive, it must be developed. And I think that due to this festival, I think Russian core of this area, Russian core population, they became fans of Turkic music. They became fans of throat singing. They became fans of this meditative music of Central Asia.
I'm glad you mentioned throat singing. How much throat singing is enough for you in one weekend?
Okay, for me, throat singing is not a trick. I mean, I cannot listen to throat singing as throat singing. I'm not that kind of Khomeini fanatic, you know, as many Californian friends of mine who just like can die for like listening throat singing for like a week or more.
No, well, you just said it, they're Californian.
I mean, first of all, Hun Huatu and the some works of Yadkha, when throat singing becomes part of Central Asian rock or Central Asian punk or whatever, they kind of created new traditional music, which is ensemble music, which is very different arrangements from whatever you can hear from herders, from shepherds. They inherited this music from their grandfathers and they really moved it forward. And now I see new young ensembles who already copy Hun Huatu or copy Yadkha. And now in Moscow, we can get like up to 1,000, 1,500 people for the single concert of Hun Huatu, for instance. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that this festival, the Siren Ring, has been running for 6-7 years now.
It's the seventh festival, yeah.
I've been very impressed this weekend, not just with the programme, the music, but also the organisation. Did you have to look at a kind of European model of how to run a festival before they embarked on this thing?
When they started the festival, they had very little knowledge of what's going on in other parts of the world. But I helped several of them to visit European festivals, for instance, WOMAD in Reading.
Because there are some very strong similarities with WOMAD.
They visited WOMAD in Reading, they visited WOMAD in Spain, they visited several other festivals like Rudolstadt in Germany, whatever. And I see how step by step, everything is improving. The technical quality became way better, way better.
Now, we're not in a relatively sophisticated and Western place like Moscow. Mm-hmm. We are a long, long way east of the Urals. You, as someone in the music business in Russia, who deals with Europeans and Americans all the time, you know as well as I do that this part of the Russian Federation has a reputation still of not being particularly sophisticated and westernised.
Yes, of course.
And there are still, the further east you come, the more it still resembles the old Soviet Union.
Our hotel is the best example.
Exactly. Our hotel is the best example. There is still very much a Soviet mindset. How do you find organising a festival down here? In other words, are you like banging your head on a wall a lot, trying to get things done?
I don't think so, but because I see that even people who are obviously not very profound, not very knowledgeable about what's going on. A lot of really provincial people are here. I see that they're really, really provincial. Maybe they even never have been in Moscow, or maybe they even never have been in Krasnoyarsk, you know. But if it's a real vibe, if it's a real genuine music which touches the heart of everybody, I don't think that we are catering something for elite or for some kind of ethnomusicologist or kind of hippies or whatever. I think that if the music is strong enough, it could penetrate to everybody. I mean, I don't see any real boundaries.
Grudel Right, just moving away from the main stage, let's go on a little walk around the festival site. I'll take you on a tour of some of the other attractions. There's much that you'd recognise from festivals more familiar to you and closer to home. Face painting just over there, a bouncy castle, obviously lots of stalls selling things like ice cream and drinks, and a craft market. I'm giving you a very wide berth, you'll notice, as wide as I can, to this Bolivian panpipes version of Country Roads Take Me Home. Let's get over here. Beads, jewellery, bangles, talismans, and every other imaginable kind of new age tat. Crocheted bikinis. Ah! Children's quad bike rides. Real quad bikes. Let them loose on motorised vehicles around a swamp. Bless their little hearts. Oh, here we go. Blocking one of the main thoroughfares through the sides, just as they cause congestion around Oxford Circus. We have devotees of the Radha Krishna Temple. And sitting on the grass verge there, at the side, are a number of chaps with the legs crossed, dressed in tangerine overalls. One of them playing the harmonium and a few of the others tapping drums. And yes, the dancers extend across the road, causing a complete pedestrian traffic jam. And of course in front of them is a big plastic tub in which you're invited to drop your bundles of rubles. The fact that most of them look like they might be refugees from Crouch End adds nothing to the sense of validity or authenticity. quite a strong police presence here. In fact, some of them gathered at that corner. It looks as though they're about to break into song. Couldn't really be a police choir, could it? No. It's policemen who haven't really got anything to do. Nothing really to police. And hey, look at this. Here's an innovation that festivals at home could perhaps learn from. There's like a water bowser here in the middle of the site, operated by two girls who are dimpling prettily, as I describe it, and it's not dispensing water, it's full of beer. And they've got some plastic sacks, big plastic sacks, alongside it, which have got a lot of empty plastic bottles in it. So you come along and you get filled up with draft beer. And I suppose you can keep coming back with your bottle all weekend. And it's the equivalent of 80 pence for a 2 litre bottle. Shame I've given up. Earlier on, playing to their local audience here at the Siren Ring Festival is of course perfectly fine, but if you come halfway around the globe to one of the world's remotest places, you do expect to hear at least a few artists you've never come across before. And this is someone a bit special, I think. With four percussion players, a traditional funeral singer and dancing girls, from Tajikistan, this is the Sufi rock singer Dale Nazarov. This morning up at the festival site, during the session allocated for sound checks, I came across a band which was previously unknown to me, and they immediately grabbed my attention. They had attitude, they had an air of righteousness, they had electric guitars, and they had dark glasses. And I thought, whoever these guys are, they mean business. And it turned out to be a band, you've just heard a snatch of them, from Tajikistan in Central Asia, the band of Dalair Nazarov. Now, you're the same age as me, Dalair, and I wonder how different our experiences were. Did you, in Tajikistan, when it was a part of the Soviet Union, did you grow up against a background of rock and roll, or was that impossible in the Tajikistan of the Soviet Union?
It's international music. It can grow everywhere. In Tajikistan, in everywhere. It's sound of freedom.
And your band now, I was very impressed during the sound check this morning when I first came across you and your group, that you're using, in my opinion, the much overlooked and underdeployed harmonica. Where does your enthusiasm for the harmonica come from?
Our traditional music, that's from Pamir. The,
it's part of Tajikistan.
Yes, part of the mountain part of Tajikistan. Yeah. The soul of this music is the same as the blues.
American blues.
Yes, yeah. I think that's maybe it's the same music, but so far from 1,000 years are going from Pamir or coming from, no matter. More important that it's the same. The feeling is same, the swing is same.
Fantastic. It's, you've used a word, you put your finger on a word that defines, identifies one of the qualities I saw in you this morning that so few groups have. Swing, that's the word. Many groups know how to rock, very few groups know how to roll or swing, and you swing. Anyway, tell us more, the connection between the blues of Pamir, the mountains of Tajikistan, and American blues.
And it's mystical music. Blues is real mystical music, and Pamir music, traditional, is mystical too. And it's music that's had a cover of sadness, but a power of happiness. Because our traditional music mostly played when somebody are dead. And by the help of this music, all blackness go out. 3 days. And not possible to teach it, no possible to learn it. It suddenly wake up inside of you from somewhere. As this man who played today with us in tambour, we say, please play 2 notes, we have sound check. And he start play and not stop. He must play till the end, and then again from the beginning. Not possible, please, 1 sentence only. He, okay, start singing and I cannot stop him. Because it's for him, it's life. Blues is same. You cannot cut it. You cannot edit it. It's like as it now.
Well, I could respond very readily to the sound of what you were doing this morning. But obviously, I don't understand the language. So, what issues are you dealing with?
Deepness of love. The many level of love. One touch is emotion and low, high. Different, until the God, love, it's old Persian literature that came from Sufyan poets, Jalaluddin Rumi, and most songs that we were saying today, they are from Jalaluddin Rumi. And it's so deep meaning that it take a long time to understand it, but we use it because it have no real meaning. At the end, you understand that you are not understand anything.
And coming from a place which is synonymous with instability, you know, the cauldron that is the turmoil of post-Soviet Central Asia, is there inevitably a political dimension to your songs as well?
No, because I'm not understand politics. Because for us, our aims is freedom. For all politics, their aims are not freedom. We want to understand them that freedom for everybody is important, but they understand that for us, we not must be free. And for that reason, I have no any interesting, because I understand that I cannot change it. I must do my work. And my work, it's outside of Tajikistan, inside and outside. Mostly we try to tell about our homeland, about our history for people that far from Tajikistan.
Are you back now living in Dushanbe, the Tajik capital? Because during the 90s, the time of the civil war there, you did leave, didn't you, and go and live in Kazakhstan?
I leave because the fighting between two parts of people that I had not any connection with one of them. As a musician, I'm always far from every kind of fighting.
Dallaire, thank you very much. And we'll enjoy a bit more now of your performance at the Siren Ring Festival.
Thank you.
Just make a move, 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 just make сегодня.
Спасибо. Большое спасибо! Большое спасибо!
The Siren Ring Festival is held in the middle of a cycle track, in a stadium, in a municipal park, on the edge of Shushenskoye. It's one of the town's less grim locations, and it's bordered by two muddy rivers. For that reason, perhaps, the festival site is at the centre of a swamp, which is the home, the incubator, in fact, to so many of Siberia's celebrated man-eating mosquitoes. They're enormous and they're insatiable. Those of you who may still feel minded to attend next year's Siren Ring, even after hearing this programme, will be well advised to first marinate yourselves in DEET for a fortnight before arrival and to bring with you your own blood. Aside from that, it's just lovely. Now, the Siren Ring gathering, like many worthy festivals the world over, offers not just the carefree opportunity to lie on the grass and listen to delightful music whilst getting pleasantly squiffy, but to analyse and dissect that music in a lot of gruesome, brow-furrowing workshops. Let me tell you what's in the lineup for these. Form an orderly queue, will you please, for a lecture on traditional culture of labour and relaxation in games and rituals, 2:15 on Friday. Then there's one on the summer cycle of calendar songs. after lunch on day two, the folk worldview reflection in a dance. And the stampede begins now for, at 10:15 tomorrow morning, the playing of forgotten Russian folk instruments. Wouldn't it be fantastic if you went along and you had to say to the woman hosting it, "Well, where are they then?" And she said, "Well, I've forgotten them." No visit to these parts, let's be honest, would be complete without a personalised, one-on-one, throat-singing masterclass. And you know me, I just live for pleasure. And this is just the man to do it. He's Albert Kvasin, who's most famous for his Tuvan rock band Yak Kar, and he was also a founder member of Hun Hua too. We often see Albert in the UK, but he still lives just a few miles from here in Tuva. Here he is, in a session for World Roots, on the banks of the Yenisei River. Albert, that is remarkable, if not a little alarming. Does it hurt when you sing like that?
When you're a beginner, it always hurts. It doesn't matter if you just start to sing or just start to have sex or start to live or just be a journalist on BBC. It is hurt. And then in the end, you start to make hurt other people.
And where are you making that sound in your body? Is it coming from the chest, the throat, or the mouth?
It starts from somewhere in the bottom of my stomach, and in the throat I just make a resonator.
Is that the
It's just a mouth,
right,
nose, cheeks, resonator. Physically it's easier to describe, but I believe that some local spirits, they help. They come together and say, "Okay, let's help this poor singer."
And does it have, or did it have historically, a function in Tuvan society as a tool of the herdsmen to communicate with their animals?
I believe 100% that First, it is a communication with animal sound, birds singing, bear roaring. And second, spiritual world. For example, modern metal band, they imitate the sound of mega cities. We just imitate sounds of our mega nature. But if there is no spirits on background, it is not music, it's just a sound.
Could you teach me how to throat sing?
You're already near.
Am I?
Yeah. You're already here in Siberia. And your voice is very good to start singing.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's the first time I've ever been
told. Very deep, full of spirits.
Well, you give me a sound and let me see whether I can imitate it.
For example, we are sitting by the river and just listen birds and just feel like a. Bird replies me.
Oh, okay.
You see?
Am I getting there?
You are already there. There are other many possibilities.
Very good. Thank you very much. But listen, do us one more. And you're going to be accompanied on this one, aren't you, by Alexander.
He played on Morinhur.
Which is a kind of two-string cello.
It kind of cello, yeah.
Yeah,
two but,
strings.
The string is not like a cello. It is many hairs.
Oh, okay.
It's like a vibra optical cable, not on the cello.
Let's see what you can do together. Albert, thanks a lot. For those of you who are nostalgic for the Russia of the Soviet era, it's a niche but very demanding corner of the travel industry, I know. Then look no further than the Hotel Tourist, Shushinskaya, the town in which this Iron Ring Festival takes place. The euphemistically named Hotel Tourist, for there are, in this town, when the festival isn't taking place, no tourists whatsoever. But still, the hotel stands, with its doors open, just about. As we approach those doors, let's just take a look at the facade. It's 1960s, Soviet design, very brutal, utilitarian, and much of the facade is made of that uniquely Soviet concrete, that type that's within about 2 or 3 years turned green, crumbled, and fell off, never to be replaced. As we walk in, into the hallway, avoiding the dragon who sits in a booth over there. And as we walk this way, we make our way to what should have been an grand spiral staircase leading up to the restaurant. It must have been really difficult to get this wrong. None of the steps on this spiral staircase is the same height. So you're about two-thirds of the way up and you think you've developed a club foot. And it brings us into the 1960s Soviet splendour that is the restaurant. And the aroma, which is drifting from the kitchen and which pervades the whole hotel, is a melange of cabbage, wet dogs and boiled animal fat. And the kind of things on the menu, well, we come down for breakfast and there is on offer stale bread, cold rice pudding with a dollop of melted margarine in the middle, with individual bowls of raw sliced cucumber. Do you want to come up to my room? Once you get the door open, which I've just managed to do, and you've also got to be careful, watch your feet there, that you don't trip over the filthy carpet as it rolls up and slides away under your feet as you come in. Perhaps the first thing that strikes you once you switch the lights on is the glory of the 1960s Soviet flower-patterned wallpaper with simulated gold embellishments. Fantastic. Right, and then we're faced with two single beds. You really would have to categorise these as contraceptive beds. They're just big enough for one person. You want to see the bathroom, don't you? There isn't a proper shower. There's a rubber pipe coming out of the tap assembly above the sink. There's no shower tray, there's no shower curtain. So you just turn on the taps, pull this lever which sends the water through the shower head rather than the tap, and then that sprays water, not just all over the ensuite bathroom, but because the door doesn't close properly on this, it sends water all over the room. So then your whole bedroom's wet through. The toilet is something else, right? Come here, look at me. It really is the throne of this room. Because at one point there has been a leak between the base of the toilet and the floor of the ensuite bathroom. Did anybody bother to find the source of that leak? No. What did they do? They came in with a wheelbarrow and they just dumped a load of concrete around the base of the toilet. So now, my toilet now rises from what looks like a Vesuvius of solidified concrete. And then I perch myself on the top of that. And I'll say one thing for this place, it's not cold. It is ferociously hot all the time. So I'll lie here sweating all night. I can't open the window, they're sealed up with years of paint. And by dawn, there are ruddy throat singers rehearsing in some room down the corridor. I think you should be able to win a romantic weekend with me in this hotel in a Radio 3 competition. So, this is the final band at the Cyan Ring Festival, and I'm delighted to see that it's one I've admired for many years, decades indeed. They've been called the grandfathers of world beat, but don't let that put you off. Here's the German-Moroccan band Dissidenten.
Too much.
Back in 1985, when I first found myself on the radio, on Radio 1, by accident, one of the first records that the Woolly Minded would categorise as world music that I played was by the group that you just heard, Dissidenten, from Germany. And back then, they'd released an album called Sahara Electric, and I just loved it. And for years and years, I imagined that Dissidenten, because of the music on that record, were a Moroccan band. And they weren't. They were German. And I'm now sitting, for the first time, face-to-face with a couple of members after 25 years, Uwe and Marilyn. Very nice to meet you after all this time. And I did believe you were a Moroccan group, but you weren't. You were kraut rockers who, like me, you got bored with Anglo-American rock music. You'd gone off into more global territory. So in that sense, you were pioneers of what came to be known as world music long before anybody had come up with the term.
That was sort of a way out to look to other neighbors than America or England. And of course the East is pretty near, and so is Morocco.
How was it received then, those first trailblazing records, your excursions into what became known as world music?
Actually, we were pretty surprised by the success, especially of this record. Yeah? It went all over the world.
Sahara Electric.
Sahara Electric, yeah, it went down to South America, Brazil. It was a big success, more than a million copies sold, and in Spain it was big.
And what did you know, Marilyn, of Moroccan music when you set out to make that record?
Yeah, I mean, I was listening before already to some traditional music, a lot from cassettes at this time. And then we all came down, bought a bus, went down with equipment.
To Morocco?
Yes.
To Morocco.
It was an adventure at the time, you know. You couldn't just jump in with your Sony microphone.
Of course, nowadays it's easy. You switch on the internet and then you have all these musicians. But then we really had to do it analog, by hand. Had to walk there more or less.
Had to go there, yeah.
We had to go there.
And you had to find the right people. No, always it's more like...
Yeah. So that took
karma,
time.
The karma thing, you know. It's like here. Suddenly we meet here after many, many years.
Maybe so we have to explain that.
The first time.
That strange story.
Well, what happened, let me tell the listeners, is I was sitting in the rather squalid hotel bar here, the tourist hotel, the other night, and Uwe and Marilyn were also in the bar. I didn't know them at the time. Uwe came up to me and said, "Excuse me, didn't you some years ago make a television programme with Billy Bragg in which you went across the Andes?" And I said, "That's right. I made a thing called Great Journeys of the World for BBC Two in the UK, and Billy and I travelled over the Andes from Bolivia to Chile." And all of a sudden, everything started to fall into place in my mind. I thought, why is this man asking me this question? Wait a minute, there's a group on the bill this weekend at the Siam Ring Festival called Dissidenten. And then I remembered in a flash, towards the end of our trip, right at the end in fact, when we'd arrived on the Chilean coast, having crossed the Andes in a town called Arica, Chile, and one of the last scenes in the documentary is Billy and I walk into a restaurant bar in Arica, and there is a Quechua panpipe ensemble, Chilean guys, sitting around playing the same tune, my favourite tune, off Dissidenten's Sahara Electric album from about 3 or 4 years previously. And I froze and thought, by what process has that Moroccan tune via Germany arrived here and is now being played on panpipes by traditional Chilean musicians? And so with Uwe and Marilyn in the bar the other night, we finally solved this mystery after more than two decades. And how did it get there, Uwe?
Well, basically, it is based on a Northern European folk song.
Is it from where?
From Sweden.
Oh.
But it came traveling all the way down from Northern Europe and from there to the Andes. Actually, the theme was the main theme of a telenovela, Sasare Kando, which emptied the streets. And you wouldn't see any housewives in South America when this series was on. It was a soap opera.
Very famous. A soap opera.
And that was the main theme, this song.
Why on earth did they pick on Fata Morgana as a theme for a Brazilian
no
soap
ideas.
Opera?
I have no idea.
A Swedish song, which had been modified in a Moroccan style by a couple of German kraut rockers. You couldn't make it up, could you? But it did. Tell me now, after all these years, what's it about?
It was prohibited for a while.
What was the song?
The song.
Why?
Yeah, because of its political content.
In Morocco?
In Morocco. But then it became so famous via Spain that the king invited all the musicians and said, if you can't beat them, join them. And then suddenly the record was out in Morocco.
And what were its political dimensions that caused problems in Morocco?
Well, their lyrics were, for the first time, not about, oh, love, where have you gone, and all that stuff. They were talking about real things in society.
They did it never with clear words.
It was implicit rather than explicit.
Everybody knew what's going on with right. some...
But King Hassan didn't like it.
I mean, it was in a way like in Eastern Germany. If you had a band and it said, a butterfly is flying across the wall or something, you know, then everybody knew what's about. Yeah?
Yeah.
That really paved the way, I think, even for things like Rai. Shep Khaled, he really acknowledged this record and the importance of it in society.
So in a way, it was aside from our own personal extraordinary experience with this song, it was a genuinely historic record. We better listen to Fata Morgana, haven't we? Hit it. They are the classic Fata Morgana, played by Dizzy Denton. Our interview chums were Marion Klein on the drums, Uwe Mulrich on bass, with Manikam Yogeshwaran on vocals and percussion, Najum Uwaza on vocals and mandolin, Elke Rogger on hurdy-gurdy, and Till Ullman on the violin. If you can stand the exhausting hours in an aeroplane, the mosquitoes, the pre-glasnost Soviet-style officialdom, and that hotel, then the Siam Ring Festival is quite charming, actually, and the music, of course, makes it all worthwhile. Stand by for details of that Radio 3 competition to win a romantic weekend with me at the Hotel Touristy after this. I'm a little bit of a
Well, I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear that the Radio 3 competition that Andy Kershaw referred to a moment ago exists only in his fevered imagination. But the hotel is real, and you can see a picture of it, the hotel bathroom, on the Radio 3 website. More edifyingly, there are also pictures from the Siam Ring Festival itself. And, of course, via the Radio 3 website, you'll also be able to listen to the programme again over the next 7 days. That edition of World Roots was produced by Roger Short. And next week's programme comes from Tamil Nadu in southern India. Lucy Duran will be making a musical journey around the area in the company of this year's World Roots Academy protégé, Harry Sivanesan. BBC Radio 3, of course, just gone 4 o'clock, and now it's time for Jazz Library. Here's Alan Shipton.
Today, Jazz Library focuses on one of the most charismatic cornet and trumpet players in British jazz, Alex Welsh. Delighted to be joined by my old Radio 3 colleague, Digby Fairweather, to talk about Alex and his music. I think before we start listening to the music, let's think about what it was that was special about Alex as a musician and as a personality.
Two things, I think, first of all, made him particularly special. One was, as a cornet player, he achieved the same kind of musicality as Muggsy Spanier. He once said to me, he said, "I regard myself as a lead cornet player." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" Because to me, a lead trumpet player, if you like, would be Maynard Ferguson or Bobby Pratt. But what he meant was that he could set down a fine Dixieland lead around which the rest of his virtuoso musicians could weave their miracles. And that's what he did perfectly. Very difficult to do, actually, I found. As a person, generous, warm-hearted, philanthropic, probably the most gentle of the top professional band leaders it was ever my privilege to meet and to become close friends with. A lot of his band's people, past and present, used to say that he was a tough, remote character. I think I was probably lucky in that I managed to find the soft side of him. But then, of course, I was a junior librarian, and he had no reason to be tough with me at all.
Let's hear the Alex that arrived in London from Scotland in 1955 with the band at one of the first Festival Hall concerts that they played. Now, this is beginning to move towards the lineup that established itself as the very long-term first edition of the band. It's got Fred Hunt on piano, it's got Roy Crimmins on trombone, who, as you say, wove counter melodies around Alex's cornet lead. I think it's the lead of this version of Panama that really stands out. Alex is really punching the thing out, supported admirably, I must say, by the drummer Pete Appleby.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Panama by Alex Welsh and his Dixielanders from their first Royal Festival Hall concert from the album Live at the Royal Festival Hall 1954-55 on the Lake label. The band, Alex on cornet with Roy Crimmins trombone, Ian Christie clarinet, Fred Hunt piano, Neville Scrimshaw guitar, Frank Thompson bass and Pete Appleby drums. Well, as I said, Digby, this became, or a slight evolution of this band, became the first stable lineup of the group. And we're going to hear a good example of that now with Alex's old friend from Scotland, Archie Semple, on clarinet. And he's the glue, really, between Roy Crimmins and Alex. This front line was one of the great 1950s British traditional bands.
And indeed, do you think we'd be qualified, Alan, to say that probably Archie Semple was one of the great jazz clarinet players?
I think anywhere. He had such a personal sound, out of Pee Wee Russell, but very much his own. And with that sort of sad, plaintive quality that's there even on an up-tempo number.
Fred Hunt told me, actually, that when Archie first was in the band, he sounded more like Ed Hall. But of course, he was a phenomenal drinker. It was very sad. He died in his late 40s. And in the later years, he became more like Pee Wee because Pee Wee was more easy to create if you'd had a lot to drink. And of course, we lost him at one of the London jazz festivals when he just walked off the stage one day and Lenny Hastings told me never played again. Very sad.
Well, you can hear him in great form here with that Pee Wee sound. This is very shortly before the track we've just heard, recorded in the studio in April 1955. And it's interesting because it's a Jelly Roll Morton piece, Shoeshiner's Drag. But Alex had the ability, which is quite rare in traditional jazz, not to copy the original record, but to stamp his own personality on it.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And you don't find that many traditional jazz bands these days searching out repertoire like Shoeshiner's Drag and such. You know, it's quite a rare thing these days.
Shoeshiner's Drag from the album It Has To Be, on Lake by Alex Welsh and his Dixielanders. And that collection is a number of EPs and singles that the Alex Welsh Band made shortly after Alex arrived in London in the mid-1950s. The band there, now with Archie Semple on clarinet, Roy Crimmins still on trombone and Fred Hunt on piano, with Neville Scrimshaw guitar, Tom Page bass, and the arrival of Lenny Hastings on drums, who's going to be a long-stay member of the band. Although, I should say, Dibby's not playing on the next track we're going to hear.
Isn't he?
Johnny Richardson joins the band for this
one. Yes, the great John Richardson, the other great Dixieland drummer in Britain.
Now, this is a track that you suggested we include because it features the remarkable Harry Gold on bass sax. Yes. And Harry goes right the way back to being taken. I remember hearing him on Radio 2 some years ago talking about his dad taking him to hear the original Dixieland band at the Hammersmith Palais.
Indeed.
In 1919.
Indeed.
And he's got this ability that bass saxophonists had to play a bass part 1 minute, competing with Bill Reed, who's playing the double bass. Mm. And then he sort of edges his way into the solo limelight. He's a very interesting man in that he wears these two roles very easily.
One of the most charming guests amongst the Alex Welsh family, who used to be invited into the ranks of the band from time to time. I remember Jerry Salisbury was an invited friend. Harry was. A few other select people, Danny Moss amongst them, used to come along and play with the band as one of the invited incorporated family of the Welsh fraternity. And they were tremendous. And Harry, I think, was particularly wonderful because he was a very humorous man and he had a huge understanding of the Bob Crosby and Red Nicholas era of Dixieland, which, of course, was, in Red's case, sort of bass saxophone heavy, was it not?
It was indeed, although we don't actually have Eddie Lang playing guitar on this track. We've got Diz Dizley.
That's not too bad.
But nevertheless, I think what stands out here is that Alex could accommodate a guest and make them feel very much part of the whole ambience of the band.
Great relaxation and beautiful music.